Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present Grenada, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 1. The First Footsteps. When I think about the beginning of Grenada's story, I'm drawn to a time before recorded history, a time when the island was an unspoiled paradise. I imagine rolling hills covered in thick forests, rivers flowing freely to the sea, and an island alive with the sounds of birds, insects, and the rustle of palm leaves in the wind. This was Grenada long before European explorers set foot here, long before the scars of colonization marked its shores. It was a land full of promise, untouched and pristine, and it became home to the first people who arrived by sea. The earliest inhabitants of Grenada were the Arawaks, a peaceful and resourceful people who made their way across the Caribbean Sea in dugout canoes. It's incredible to imagine their journey, guided only by the stars and their deep knowledge of the ocean's currents. They were pioneers in every sense, bringing with them their customs, their tools, and their way of life to this new land. As they stepped onto the island's shores, I imagined their awe at the beauty of this place. To them, Grenada must have seemed like a paradise, its fertile soil, abundant waters, and dense forests providing everything they needed to thrive. The Arawaks were skilled farmers, planting cassava, sweet potatoes, and other crops that formed the backbone of their diet. They were artisans too, crafting beautiful pottery and intricate tools from stone and shells. Their villages, likely nestled near rivers or along the coast, were centers of community and culture. Family storytelling and rituals were at the heart of their lives, connecting them to each other and to the spirits they believed governed the natural world. But their time on Grenada was not without challenges. The Kalinago, known as the Caribs, arrived on the island generations later, and their arrival marked a turning point in its early history. The Kalinago were warriors, fiercely protective of their people and their territory. Unlike the Arawaks, they were a more nomadic society, living in smaller groups and relying heavily on hunting, fishing, and raiding for their survival. The Kalinago were known for their seafaring skills, navigating vast distances across the Caribbean in canoes that could carry dozens of men. They were also deeply spiritual, their rituals tied to the rhythms of the natural world and their connection to their ancestors. The Kalinago dominance over the region, including Grenada, didn't come peacefully. The Arawaks were gradually displaced, their culture and presence fading over time as the Kalinago established themselves. I often wonder about the battles fought, the lives lost, and the resilience of those who tried to hold onto their way of life. It's a story of survival and adaptation, of strength in the face of change. The Kalinago, in turn, built their own legacy on Grenada. They gave the island its first recorded name, Camerhone, and left behind a cultural imprint that still lingers. Their villages were strategically placed, often in locations that provided clear views of the coastline to watch for invaders. Their craftsmanship was remarkable, from the weapons they forged to the intricate carvings they created. They lived off the land, fishing in the turquoise waters and harvesting from the island's rich resources. What strikes me most about these first inhabitants, both the Arawaks and the Kalinago, is their deep connection to the land. They didn't see themselves as separate from nature, but as a part of it, living in harmony with their surroundings. They took only what they needed, honoring the spirits of the earth, sea, and sky in their daily lives. This balance allowed them to thrive for centuries, creating a foundation for life on Grenada that would endure even as the world around them began to change. Today, traces of their presence can still be found. Petroglyphs, ancient carvings etched into rock, offer a glimpse into their beliefs and traditions. These symbols, weathered by time, are like whispers from the past, inviting us to imagine the hands that carved them and the stories they tell. Archaeologists have also uncovered shards of pottery, tools, and other artifacts that speak to the ingenuity and creativity of these early peoples. As I delve deeper into Granada's history, I find myself filled with admiration for these first inhabitants. Their resilience, resourcefulness, and respect for the land laid the groundwork for everything that came after. Their footsteps may have faded, but their spirit lingers in the rhythm of the waves, the rustle of the trees, and the stories passed down through generations. This is where the story of Granada begins, not with conquest or colonization, but with the courage of those who ventured across the sea to find a new home, and the strength of those who defended it. As we journey through the chapters of this island's history, I'll carry their legacy with me, letting their wisdom and connection to the land guide us forward. Their story is not just Granada's. It's a story of humanity, of how we all begin, searching for a place to belong. Chapter 2. The Age of Exploration. Granada, as we know it today, was shaped by a period of dramatic transformation during the Age of Exploration. It's easy to view this time through the lens of romantic adventure. Brave explorers setting out into uncharted waters, discovering lands rich with beauty and resources. But to truly understand this era, we must step into the shoes of all the participants. Not just the explorers, but also the people who had lived here for centuries, the Kalinago. For them, this was not a time of discovery but of invasion, resistance, and ultimately, a fight for survival. The first glimpse. The story begins in 1498, during Christopher Columbus's third voyage to the Americas. As his ships sailed into the southern Caribbean, Granada emerged on the horizon, a gem of an island lush and green, with rolling hills and pristine beaches. Columbus, captivated by its beauty, named it Concepcion. This initial encounter was fleeting. Columbus never set foot on the island. To him, it was just one of many stops on a journey driven by the promise of wealth and conquest. But that glimpse marked the beginning of a new chapter for Granada. The Europeans had taken notice, and it was only a matter of time before their ambitions brought them back. The Kalinago Resistance. At the time of Columbus's sighting, Granada was home to the Kalinago, also known as the Caribs. They were skilled warriors, adept at navigating the seas, and fiercely protective of their territory. The Kalinago had already established dominance in the region, having displaced the earlier Arawak inhabitants through a combination of warfare and assimilation. Their society was organized around communal living, with a deep respect for the natural world. They viewed Granada not just as a place to live, but as a sacred homeland, integral to their identity. When the Europeans returned, they encountered this fiercely independent people. The first serious attempt to colonize Granada came in 1609, when a group of English settlers landed on the island. They hoped to establish a foothold, perhaps envisioning a life of prosperity and opportunity. But they were unprepared for the resistance they faced. The Kalinago, armed with bows, arrows, and their intimate knowledge of the terrain, launched a ferocious defense. The English, unable to withstand the onslaught, were forced to abandon their efforts and retreat. It was a victory for the Kalinago, a testament to their resilience and their unwillingness to cede their land to outsiders. The French invasion. The English failure did not deter other European powers. In 1650, the French turned their attention to Granada, led by Jacques du Parquet, the governor of Martinique. They sought to claim the island for France. Du Parquet purchased Granada from a French company that had laid claim to it. Though this transaction was entirely symbolic, it ignored the fact that the island was already inhabited and fiercely defended. The French invasion was methodical. They established settlements, brought soldiers, and began to carve out territories. The Kalinago fought back, but this time, they were up against an enemy with superior weaponry and resources. The resistance culminated in one of the most tragic episodes in Granada's history, the Battle of Leaper's Hill. Outnumbered and outgunned, the remaining Kalinago warriors and their families faced an impossible choice. Rather than surrender to the French, they chose death, leaping from the cliffs into the sea. It was an act of defiance and desperation, a heartbreaking reminder of the price they paid to protect their homeland. Today, Leaper's Hill stands as a somber monument to the Kalinago's courage and sacrifice. When I visit the site, I feel a profound sense of loss, but also immense respect. Their story is one of resilience in the face of unimaginable odds, a legacy that endures in Granada's identity. The transformation of Granada. With the Kalinago resistance crushed, the French set about transforming Granada. They established plantations, introducing crops like sugarcane, cocoa, and tobacco. To work the land, they relied on enslaved Africans, beginning a dark chapter of exploitation and suffering. The island's landscape changed, its natural beauty giving way to rows of crops cultivated for export. Granada became a part of the transatlantic economy, its fate tied to the demands of European markets. At the same time, the French sought to impose their culture on the island. They built churches, established governance structures, and introduced their language and customs. Yet, even as they sought to reshape Granada, the spirit of resistance persisted, not just among the enslaved Africans who would later rise up against their oppressors, but in the very land itself, which seemed to hold the memory of its first inhabitants. The duality of exploration. The age of exploration is often celebrated as a time of progress, discovery, and the expansion of human horizons. And in some ways it was. The Europeans who ventured into the Caribbean were driven by curiosity, ambition, and a desire to chart the unknown. But this era also brought devastation. For the Kalinago, exploration meant displacement, loss, and the erasure of their way of life. As I reflect on this period, I am struck by its duality. It was a time of incredible human achievement, crossing vast oceans, mapping new territories, and establishing connections across continents. But it was also a time of deep human tragedy, as cultures were destroyed and people subjugated in the name of empire. Granada's story during the age of exploration is not a simple one. It is a story of beauty and violence, of ambition and resistance. It reminds us that history is never one-sided, that every moment of progress often comes at a cost. And as we move forward in this journey, we will see how the legacy of this era shaped the Granada we know today, an island of resilience, diversity, and enduring strength. Chapter 3, Blood and Sugar. As I reflect on Granada's story during the colonial era, I'm reminded of the profound duality that defines this chapter. The island's breathtaking beauty juxtaposed with the unimaginable brutality of its transformation into a sugar colony. The sweet scent of sugarcane fields wafting through the air may seem idyllic at first glance, but beneath that surface lies a history steeped in blood, sweat, and sorrow. This is the story of how Granada became a part of the vast and ruthless machinery of the transatlantic slave trade, and the resilience of the people who bore its weight. The French colonization and the plantation system. By the mid-17th century, the French had solidified their control over Granada following their violent conquest of the Kalinago. What began as small settlements quickly expanded into a full-fledged colonial enterprise. The French, like other European powers, saw the Caribbean as a gold mine, not for precious metals, but for the fertile land that could sustain cash crops in high demand across Europe. Granada, with its rich volcanic soil and tropical climate, was perfectly suited for sugarcane cultivation. The plantation system in Granada was not just an economic venture. It was an entire way of life imposed upon the island. The French divided the land into estates, each managed by colonists who sought to maximize profits. These estates were sprawling operations, requiring significant labor to clear forests, plant crops, and process sugarcane into molasses and sugar crystals for export. But who would perform this grueling labor? The answer lay in the transatlantic slave trade, a system so vast and cruel that it defies comprehension. Between the 17th and 19th centuries, millions of Africans were forcibly taken from their homelands, packed onto ships under inhumane conditions, and sold into slavery across the Americas and the Caribbean. Granada was no exception. The island became a key node in this network, its sugar plantations fueled by the labor of enslaved Africans. The Middle Passage and arrival in Granada. It's hard to imagine the terror and despair experienced by the Africans who were taken from their homes and subjected to the Middle Passage, the journey across the Atlantic Ocean. Ships built for human cargo were overcrowded, with individuals chained together in the stifling, dark holds below deck. Disease, malnutrition, and abuse claimed countless lives during the voyage. Those who survived arrived on Grenada's shores in a state of physical and emotional devastation. Once on the island, the enslaved Africans were sold at auctions, their humanity reduced to a price tag. Families were torn apart, their bonds severed in an instant. For many, their first sight of Grenada would have been the plantation fields where they would toil under the harshest conditions. Life on the plantations. The plantation was a world of relentless labor and cruelty. Enslaved men, women, and children worked from dawn until dusk, cutting sugarcane under the sweltering sun. The process of refining sugar was no less arduous, boiling the cane juice in massive copper kettles, often at great personal risk. Burns and injuries were common, and there was no respite for those who suffered. The overseers, often brutal and unyielding, enforced discipline with whips and other forms of punishment. Resistance was met with swift and severe retribution, but that didn't stop enslaved people from finding ways to push back. Some slowed their work, others sabotaged equipment, and many risked their lives to escape, seeking refuge in the dense forests and mountains of the island. Despite the unimaginable hardships, the enslaved community found ways to preserve their humanity. They brought with them traditions, languages, and spiritual practices from Africa, adapting them to their new environment. These cultural threads became the foundation of Grenadian identity, a testament to the resilience and creativity of the human spirit. The rise of the sugar economy. By the 18th century, Grenada had become one of the Caribbean's most productive sugar colonies. Sugar was not just a commodity. It was the lifeblood of the European economy, driving trade and wealth across the Atlantic world. The sugar produced in Grenada and other islands was shipped to Europe, where it was used to sweeten tea, coffee, and desserts, becoming a staple of daily life. The profits from sugar fueled the rise of powerful plantation owners, who built lavish homes and lived in relative luxury. But this wealth came at an unimaginable cost. For every pound of sugar produced, lives were lost, families were broken, and the environment was irrevocably altered. Forests were cleared to make way for plantations, and the island's natural resources were exploited to the brink. Resistance and rebellion. Even under the harshest conditions, the enslaved people of Grenada never lost their will to fight for freedom. Throughout the 18th century, acts of resistance became increasingly bold. Enslaved individuals escaped to the mountains, forming maroon communities where they could live free from the tyranny of the plantation system. These communities, though small and constantly under threat, were symbols of defiance and hope. The most significant act of rebellion came in the late 18th century, during Julian Feeden's uprising. Though Feeden himself was a free man of color, his rebellion drew support from enslaved Africans and sought to overthrow British rule, following their conquest of the island from the French in 1763. The rebellion was a watershed moment in Grenadian history, and though it ultimately failed, it demonstrated the power of collective resistance and the enduring desire for freedom. The human cost of sugar. As I dig deeper into this chapter of Grenada's history, I am struck by the scale of human suffering that underpinned the sugar economy. The lives of countless individuals, men, women, and children, were consumed by this system, their labor enriching distant empires while they endured unspeakable hardship. But I am also inspired by their resilience. In the face of unimaginable oppression, they found ways to survive, to resist, and to preserve their culture. Their legacy is woven into the fabric of Grenada, a reminder of the strength and spirit of those who came before. A changing world. By the early 19th century, the tide was beginning to turn. The abolitionist movement gained momentum in Europe, fueled by the testimonies of formerly enslaved individuals and growing moral opposition to slavery. In 1834, slavery was abolished throughout the British Empire, including Grenada. But emancipation was only the beginning of a new struggle, as formerly enslaved people faced the daunting task of building levees in a system still stacked against them. Chapter 4. The Roots of Resistance. Granada's story of resistance begins not as a singular act, but as a continuous, pulsing rhythm, an unbroken thread of defiance woven through the centuries. The land itself, with its lush mountains and dense forests, became both a sanctuary and a symbol of resilience. The people, first the Kalinago, then the enslaved Africans, carried within them a fierce determination to fight against oppression in all its forms. In this chapter, we will explore the deep roots of resistance that have defined Granada's history, focusing on the acts of defiance that arose during the era of slavery and culminated in one of the most significant uprisings in Caribbean history, Julian Fedon's Rebellion. The legacy of the Kalinago resistance. The seeds of resistance in Granada were planted long before the arrival of enslaved Africans. The Kalinago, the island's original inhabitants, were among the first to fight against European colonizers. Their resistance to the Spanish, English, and French was not just about protecting their land. It was a fight to preserve their way of life, their culture, and their identity. While the Kalinago were ultimately overpowered by the French in the 17th century, their spirit of defiance endured, passed down through the generations. Leaper's Hill, where the Kalinago chose death over surrender, became a symbol of their bravery. It is said that their spirits remain, guarding the island and inspiring future generations to fight against tyranny. As we move through this chapter, we'll see how this legacy of resistance shaped Granada's collective identity, providing a foundation for the struggles to come. Enslaved Africans and early acts of defiance. When the French established sugar plantations in Granada, they relied on the labor of enslaved Africans to fuel their economic ambitions. These men, women, and children were torn from their homelands, forced to endure the horrors of the Middle Passage, and subjected to unimaginable cruelty on the plantations. Yet, even in the face of such oppression, they resisted. Resistance among the enslaved took many forms. Some were subtle, acts of defiance that disrupted the plantation system without drawing immediate retaliation. Others were bold and direct, involving escape, sabotage, and uprisings. Subtle resistance. Enslaved Africans found ways to assert their humanity in the smallest acts. They worked slower than expected, pretended not to understand instructions, or feigned illness to disrupt the plantation's operations. These acts of resistance, though small, were deeply significant. They were a way of reclaiming agency in a system designed to strip them of their autonomy. Cultural preservation. Despite the brutal conditions, enslaved people preserved their culture through song, dance, language, and spirituality. They practiced traditional African religions, often disguising their rituals as Christian practices to avoid punishment. These cultural expressions became a form of resistance, a way to maintain a sense of identity and community. Maroon communities. Some enslaved Africans escaped the plantations altogether, fleeing into Granada's dense forests and rugged mountains. There, they formed Maroon communities, independent settlements where they could live free from the control of the colonizers. These communities were a testament to the resilience and ingenuity of the enslaved, and they became a thorn in the side of the plantation system. Maroons conducted raids on plantations, freeing other enslaved people and disrupting the colonial economy. The Rising Tide, Julian Fedon's Rebellion. By the late 18th century, the spirit of resistance had reached a boiling point. The spark came in 1795, when Julian Fedon, a free man of color and a plantation owner, led one of the most significant uprisings in Caribbean history. Fedon's rebellion was inspired by the ideals of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity, as well as the Haitian Revolution, which had successfully overthrown French colonial rule in Saint-Domingue, now Haiti. The catalyst. Fedon's rebellion was fueled by the deep inequalities and injustices of Grenadian society. The British had taken control of the island from the French in 1763, following the Treaty of Paris, and had imposed harsh policies that marginalized free people of color and enslaved Africans. Fedon, who was of French and African descent, was deeply influenced by the revolutionary movements sweeping the region. He saw an opportunity to challenge British rule and fight for a more just society. The uprising begins. The rebellion began on March 2, 1795, when Fedon and his followers launched a surprise attack on Grenville, a major town on the eastern coast of the island. The rebels targeted British officials and plantation owners, executing many and taking control of the area. From there, the rebellion spread like wildfire, with enslaved Africans joining the cause in large numbers. Tactics and strategies. Fedon and his followers used guerrilla tactics, taking advantage of Grenada's rugged terrain to outmaneuver British forces. They established a stronghold in the mountains near Belvedere Estate, where they could plan their attacks and defend themselves against counterattacks. The rebels were well organized and motivated, and they posed a significant challenge to the British. The role of enslaved Africans. The rebellion was not just about Fedon and the free people of color. It was also a mass uprising of the enslaved population. For many, joining the rebellion was a chance to fight for their freedom and take revenge against their oppressors. The involvement of enslaved Africans gave the rebellion its strength and its moral urgency. The British response. The British, caught off guard by the scale and intensity of the rebellion, responded with brutal force. They sent reinforcements from neighboring islands and imposed martial law. The fighting was fierce and bloody, with heavy casualties on both sides. The British eventually regained control of the island, but only after a protracted and costly campaign. The fall of Fedon. Fedon's rebellion came to an end in 1796, but his fate remains a mystery. Some accounts suggest that he was killed in battle, while others claim that he escaped into the mountains and lived out the rest of his life in hiding. What is certain is that his rebellion left an indelible mark on Grenada's history, inspiring future generations to continue the fight for freedom. The legacy of resistance. Julian Fedon's rebellion was more than just a military conflict. It was a powerful statement against injustice and a testament to the resilience of Grenada's people. It showed that even in the face of overwhelming odds, the fight for freedom could not be extinguished. The rebellion also had a profound impact on Grenada society, shaking the foundations of colonial rule and forcing the British to reckon with the realities of resistance. As I reflect on this chapter, I am struck by the courage and determination of those who fought for their freedom. Their stories remind us that resistance is not just a moment in history. It is a continuous struggle, a flame that burns through generations. The roots of resistance in Grenada run deep, nourished by the sacrifices of those who came before.